Families, no rest for the souls of the victims except with knowledge of the truth and accountability. The investigation into the port explosion, which began in August 2020, has been stalled since December 2021. Investigating Judge Tariq Bitar, who tried to resume his investigations in January 2023, is banned from traveling today and is himself under investigation. And in light of the prevention of taking the necessary legal measures, there are no answers in the horizon. Given the enormity of the Beirut port disaster, one of the most powerful non-nuclear explosions in history, this delay in achieving justice and accountability in Lebanon increases the suffering of the victims' families, who have the right to know what happened and who bears responsibility for this calamity. The absence of transparency and accountability is not in the interest of Lebanon, and this means that lessons were not learned and those responsible for what happened were not punished. Yet, in the midst of all this confusion, something suspicious is going on. Taking advantage of the obstruction in the judicial process and continuous foreign interference in Lebanon, U.S. proxies in Lebanon, along with many European embassies, have called on the authorities to place relevant documents and files related to the explosion at the disposal of external investigations. More than 30 countries, along with Samir Jaja's coalition of political blocs in Lebanon, have submitted a joint statement before the Human Rights Council expressing their so-called concern and frustration over the failure to complete the Lebanese investigation and have urged Lebanon to reside to an international investigation. Been there, done that. This will only bring more disaster and fracture to the Lebanese political scene and possibly increase security threats. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. After the Beirut port explosion, which killed more than 235 people and injured 7,000, the investigation file on the accident is still forgotten and faces several obstacles, mainly related to the political crisis in the country. The explosion, whose third anniversary fell on Friday, August 4th, has essentially exacerbated the economic crisis, whose features had begun about a year before the blast and accelerated after it, to a point that 80% of the population are living below the poverty line. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, expert in human rights law and editor-in-chief of the Al-Qaws magazine, which is a weekly supplement devoted to justice and fairness issued by Beirut News Company. Thank you, Dr. Nashabi, for being with us now. The Lebanese regime, according to what political sources have been claiming, used judicial and political tools to undermine the investigation into the 2020 Beirut port explosion. That's just against all logic. Why would the Lebanese authority, or at least those who are currently right now in power, would want to see the investigation of the biggest non-nuclear blast in history being undermined?
Yes. Thank you for having me on the show. The investigation since the beginning was flawed. There was a problem with the investigation because the investigation did not move swiftly and quickly in order to depict all the information and actually survey the crime scene in a proper way. Also, the search and rescue efforts in the first week were very, very slow, and there were so many challenges and problems. Now, what happened later is that they changed the investigator because there was a political divide, and the judicial system in Lebanon, the judicial authority is not independent. And this is a crime where the explosion took place in the seaport, and the seaport is government property. It's the responsibility of the government. So logically, it's the government should investigate itself. And that's a challenge, especially in a country where you don't have an independent judiciary. So this is actually what happened in a nutshell, and it's ongoing now. This is a serious crisis because, every political group is accusing the other political group of being responsible of it, and there is a kind of a chaos when it comes to media. Also, there are so many leaks, or what is claimed to be leaks, that are all over the TVs and the media, and that is really inappropriate because the investigation is supposed to be confidential, whereas the trial is supposed to be public, whereas, you know, apparently every political group with their media are publishing parts of documents and documents that they claim are authentic about the investigation, and we can't know if these documents are authentic or not, or what's happening. I mean, this requires a qualified independent judiciary, and this is what we don't have in Lebanon, unfortunately, at the time being. So the politicians are taking over, and the media is making, you know, getting out stories as per convenience, and this is inappropriate. We're supposed to have a judicial authority that takes over and that works in a confidential way until the whole investigation is transferred to a court of law in order to have fair trial.
Well, Dr. Nashebi, we all know that we have a flawed system in the judicial system in Lebanon, but at the same time, you are seeing some suspicious behavior from some of the U.S. allies inside of Lebanon, along with more than 30 countries with their embassies in Lebanon, led by the Lebanese forces, once war criminal Samir Jaja, who sent a petition to the Human Rights Watch, along with officials, parliamentarians, diplomats, and representatives of humanitarian organizations. They all are pushing the Human Rights Council to form an international fact-finding committee into the Beirut port. I mean, do they have a point there? And if not, then why not just push for a better Lebanese judiciary to take its role and put those accountable in their places?
Exactly. Well, you see, because there are so many divisions in Lebanon, and probably the viewers know these strong divisions and know the American interference in Lebanese affairs and the Israeli pressure also on European countries and Americans to actually create groups that are capable of countering Hezbollah and countering the resistance, so that in case the resistance, or when the resistance clashes with the Israelis, they could utilize, you know, some of the groups that they encourage in order to fight Hezbollah and hit him in the back. So this is known, and this is what the Israelis and the Europeans and the Americans are trying to do. And
what does that have to be with any fact-finding mission?
Well, this is good, because they are trying to say that this horrible crime, and they said it a few days ago, that there is a responsibility, a main responsibility for Hezbollah, and that the nitrate ammonium stored in the seaport belongs to Hezbollah. They're saying these claims without any evidence or any indication that is a serious indication. Why would Hezbollah store all this nitrate ammonium?
Despite the fact that we
there?
Have spoken on this show before now,
yes,
last year to be exact, and we said where this shipment came from, who's the man
exactly.
responsible, where his offices are
exactly.
in the UK, which are registered in the UK government.
Yes.
So why all of a sudden calling for a fact-finding mission, an international one, to come to Lebanon? And who's going to pay for it?
Well, because they're taking advantage of the fact that the system, the judicial system, is flawed. They're taking advantage that the fact that there is no independent judiciary in Lebanon, that's true. But that doesn't mean automatically that we will go and call upon the international community or the United Nations to bring in a fact-finding mission. That will not help in reforming the judicial system and fixing the problem. What they want to do is, and they've been calling for an internationalization of disputes between the Lebanese. Although
it's like repeating what we went through.
Exactly.
And it is the definition of madness, because we know the results.
And
I mean, in your opinion, what if this is just another plot to politically target certain Lebanese groups, and we are here all talking about the Lebanese resistance?
I think it's not really
what will
a plot.
Happen to the country?
Yes, it's not really a plot. It's an attempt, and a desperate attempt. And really, I mean, it doesn't work this way, and it's not going to work, because the international community, I mean, they did this before, and actually they're asking the Human Rights Council to actually set up a fact-finding mission. If the Human Rights Council, first of all, who's going to pay for that? Will the Human Rights Council actually want to pay so much money? And then what's the fact-finding mission? How's it going to have to do? How's it going to be relationship between the fact-finding mission and the Lebanese authorities? Do we undermine also Lebanese sovereignty? And after the report comes out, how is it going to be translated into something tangible where the actual guilty people are going to be held accountable? How is this going to work? I mean, this is all just a political slogan by a group of frustrated people who are taking advantage of the victims, taking advantage of the fact that the country is so saddened by this horrible crime, mm-hmm. and trying to use it in a very horrible way to serve a political program and to serve their political agenda, that is to side with the Western powers who are pressured by Israel in order to attack Hezbollah internally. And that is what they're doing. And amidst the economic crisis, the Europeans and the Americans and perhaps some Gulf countries are ready to pay a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, when you have such a economic crisis, this thing becomes attractive to many in Lebanon, unfortunately.
I do understand, and I think 9 or 8 minutes are not enough to analyze the situation, given the fact that we now know, because of the pushing of the U.S. and Israel, that they might actually have a hand in that, but that's another topic to discuss with you, Dr. Omar Nashebi, whether they do have a hand or not, or whether they took advantage of the Lebanese corruption, for that matter. Dr. Nashebi, expert in human rights law and editor-in-chief of the Al-Qaws magazine, thank you very much for being with us and discussing the anniversary of the third anniversary of the explosion of the port of Beirut. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about another man in Lebanon that brought the economy to its knees.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Over the years, he was the godfather of the stability of the Lebanese lira and the recovery of the economy after the Lebanese Civil War. And he won awards and was even honored at the U.S. Treasury. But the governor of the Banque du Liban, or the Lebanese Central Bank, Riyad Salemi, ended last week a tenure that lasted four decades. After pressure from wide segments of the Lebanese, European, and even local judicial investigations about his wealth and his performance, and amid an unprecedented economic collapse in the country. More details in this following report.
The epicenter of the financial earthquake is the Central Bank of Lebanon. Riyad Salemi has run the bank for 30 years, which makes it the longest period in the service of a central bank governor in the world. For most of that time, Salemi claimed to champion a stable and conservative philosophy of monetary policy. But behind the era of easy money was what the World Bank and heads of state, including French President Emmanuel Macron, have called a Ponzi scheme. As times became more difficult within the Lebanese state, the Bank of Lebanon began to struggle to pay its debts, and the country's commercial banks began to falter as well. To buy time, Salemi embarked on a few rounds of cheap credit, but he eventually came up with a more desperate solution, relying on the commercial banks themselves to fill holes in his cash reserves. When people started to feel the pain of the rising cost of living, that setup also stopped. The financial system collapsed in 2019, and the country stopped paying off foreign debt burdens. Since late 2019, the Lebanese have been suffering from an unprecedented economic crisis, which led to a historic collapse in the value of the Lebanese lira and a sharp deterioration in the purchasing power of citizens, while banks continued the policy of withholding deposits and handing over parts of them to depositors according to circulars that depreciated the money's real value. All that happened at a time when the exchange rate of the dollar on the black market hit the barriers of 100,000 Lebanese lira. Today, the Lebanese economy is in shambles. Inflation exceeded 170% last year, and credit rating agencies say this year could be worse. Salemi left office end of July rather than seeking another six-year term. Before his planned retirement to his villa overlooking Beirut, his most loyal companion may be his Cohiba cigar. In May, French and German prosecutors issued arrest warrants for Salemi in connection with an investigation that has spanned six countries. The allegations include the purchase of real estate in those countries using millions of dollars of stolen Lebanese public funds. In Lebanon, however, Salemi remained remarkably untouched. He was free to smoke cigars in his office while the vanishing middle class was left to desperately consider its options. For 2 years, Salemi's wealth has been the focus of investigations in Lebanon and Europe. The man who won regional and international awards and accolades of honor in recognition of his efforts in office and was the first Arab Central Bank governor to have the opening bell of the New York Stock Exchange ring for him insists that he accumulated his wealth from his previous work for 2 decades in the global financial institution Merrill Lynch and from investments in several fields far from his work as the head of the governorship of Lebanon's Central Bank. With political cover, Salemi has been involved since 2016 in financial engineering aimed at preserving the value of the Lebanese lira, raising the central bank's reserves and capitalizing banks. But economists consider it among the main reasons that contributed to the deepening of the country's financial crisis. With the onset of a liquidity scarcity crisis and banks imposing strict restrictions on withdrawing deposits, especially in U.S. dollars, in the fall of 2019, Riyad Salemi insisted in the first month that the Lebanese lira is fine. Today, more than 3 years after a collapse that the World Bank ranked among the worst in the world since 1850, the local currency has lost more than 98% of its value against the U.S. dollar. Despite the criticisms that affected his performance and the suspicions that persecuted him in London and abroad, Salemi remained in his position. Some believe that he was aspiring to be a candidate for the presidency of the republic, which justifies him not rejecting any request from the political class. Despite the investigations that began affecting him 2 years ago, Salemi insisted on remaining in his position until the last moment. European investigators suspect that he illegally accumulated real estate and banking assets and that he misused public funds on a large scale during his tenure as governor of the Lebanese Central Bank. Based on the investigations, a French judge in Paris and the public prosecutor in Munich issued 2 arrest warrants against Salemi, which were circulated through Interpol. But Salemi rejected the charges against him, deeming them falsified statements based on political grounds. Only one thing is certain, and that is that the exit of Riyad Salemi from the top position in the central bank will not be the end of the economic crisis in Lebanon. With no one named after him and no real solutions on the horizon, public anger towards Lebanon's banks will merely continue to grow.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ghassan Jawad, writer and politician, head of the Lebanese Group for Media and Political Studies and the owner and editor-in-chief of the digital newspaper Beirut Press. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ghassan. Now, the governor of the Central Bank of Lebanon, Riyad Salemi, stepped down after 30 years in office, but he is leaving behind an economy in shambles and a country experiencing one of the worst financial crises in the world. But is that it? Just Riyad Salemi leaves without any accountability?
Unfortunately, this scene that appeared during Riyad Salemi's escape from the central bank building is a provocative and disturbing scene for many Lebanese, especially the Lebanese whose deposits were suspended in the banks. So I don't think him leaving means it's over. Riyad Salemi is attached to judicial files inside and outside Lebanon. Of course, he enjoys political protections that allowed him to go out without accountability today. But these political protections, with the passage of time, will diminish and weaken their ability to protect Riyad Salemi. And therefore, sooner or later, we will see Riyad Salemi a subject of serious trials. Therefore, we demand, as we demanded previously, that the trial be national in the national judiciary, rather than allowing Lebanon to be subjected to more international judicial permissibility. But if he is not held accountable at home, the logic of the international judiciary's rejection becomes weak in the face of this reality.
Well, Mr. Jawad, many blame Riyad Salemi for the collapse of the Lebanese economy. We have more than 80% of the Lebanese population living now under the poverty line. But Salemi is considered the most prominent member of the Lebanese political elite to which arrows of criticism are directed. And protesters against him, they keep raising his images, insulting him, saying that he is to be blamed. But let us be real here. He has been a very close friend to basically all of the political elite in Lebanon since after the civil war. How come he's taking the fall on his own, or at least publicly so?
The Lebanese formula and the nature of the economic and financial system that was built after the year 1990 is a vanguard that expresses partnerships. This existed between part of the political class and part of the capitalists and bank owners. Therefore, what protects Riyad Salami today in depth is the Lebanese formula, which is the Lebanese composition, the high sectarian tendency and the unwillingness of many to be held accountable. This tells us how we got here and how these policies adopted by Riyad Salami led to an unprecedented economic and financial problem. Therefore, yes, his relations with the political class secured him protections, but these protections will weaken, in my opinion, with the passage of time, without losing sight of the fact that he has American protection in the first place. I personally consider Riyad Salami an American administration officer working for the Americans in Lebanon, and he is responsible for all the financial and economic policy that led to making Lebanon weak before foreign wills and the will of the United States of America. These policies allowed a form of tutelage over Lebanon that is still practiced by the United States of America.
Well, we also have the problem of banks in Lebanon, where they are continuing the policy of withholding the deposits of the public and handing over parts of them to the depositors, according to Riyad Salami's circulars that made the money lose its value considerably. What will be the policy of the government towards these banks in the post-Riyad Salami era?
We are in a crisis of depositors in Lebanon, an unprecedented crisis on the face of the globe. When a state and commercial banks withhold the deposits of the Lebanese public under the auspices of the Central Bank of Lebanon, is a matter that the political forces must reject. They must reject this reality and work on finding legislation and laws that preserve the deposits of the Lebanese and lead to preserving their monetary value and not exposing people to more losses. It is enough that they have already lost their deposits for a period of time and are unable to access these deposits. Many of the practices carried out by some officials in Lebanon to write off these deposits and not to preserve the rights of these people is the title of a great battle for the honorable and patriotic political forces that want to preserve the interests of the people. They must fight this battle with the law, the media, politics, and legislation.
But we are speaking about the same judiciary system that has not been able to put a point on the perpetrators of the August 4, 2020 explosion. Will they be able to put their hands on this one, on the commercial banks?
We must establish a national authority and a national judiciary, strengthen and support the local national judiciary, and approve projects for the independence of the judiciary in order to weaken the ability of the political class to control the judiciary. In this sense, the judiciary can then prosecute, achieve justice, and deal with the depositor's file, the port explosion file, and any other file of a criminal nature or of a nature related to justice for the Lebanese public. We have no choice but to bet on national institutions, because the alternative will be a group of external tutelages that will increase international interference and weaken the factor of national participation in determining the fate and future of Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Ghassan Jawad, writer and politician, head of the Lebanese Group for Media and Political Studies, and the owner and editor-in-chief of the digital newspaper Beirut Press, thank you very much for your contribution to our show. Ladies and gents, thank you. I hope to see you again soon next week on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the United States, the Supreme Court has allowed the Biden administration's restrictions on ghost guns. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Supreme Court on Tuesday, 8th of August, paused the lower court decision that invalidated the Biden administration's efforts to regulate so-called ghost guns, allowing enforcement of the restrictions while legal proceedings continue. The 5-4 order from the Supreme Court came hours before a temporary pause issued by Justice Samuel Alito, who handles requests for emergency relief arising from states including Texas, was set to expire. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined with the three liberal justices to freeze the lower court's ruling, while Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh said they would deny the request from the Biden administration to revive the rules. The White House commended the Supreme Court's decision to temporarily pause the lower court orders blocking its efforts aimed at curbing gun violence. While this case is being litigated, the Supreme Court's action will keep in place important efforts to combat the surge of unserialized, privately made ghost guns, which have proliferated in crime scenes across the country. Olivia Dalton, the White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary, said in a statement, "The legal battle arrived at the Supreme Court late last month when the Biden administration asked the High Court to reinstate the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives regulation targeting ghost guns while proceedings continue in the lower courts of law. The measure from ATF, the Bureau for Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, which took effect in August of 2022, updated the rules regarding the definition of a firearm under the Gun Control Act to address the proliferation of ghost guns, which are untraceable firearms that can be made from kits available online and assembled at home. The rule defined firearm to include ghost gun kits and clarified the definition of frames or receivers, which are also sold in kits. Under the law, manufacturers and sellers of certain kits are required to obtain licenses, mark their products with serial numbers, conduct background checks and maintain records to allow law enforcement to trace the firearms when used in crimes. The rule does not prohibit the purchase, sale or possession of any gun, nor does it bar a person legally allowed to have a firearm from making one at home. A group of gun owners, advocacy groups and entities that make or sell products covered by the rule challenged portions of ATF's restrictions last year, arguing they are unlawful. A federal district court first blocked the challenge provisions prohibiting the Biden administration from enforcing them. Then, on 5th of July, U.S. District Court Judge Reed O'Connor ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and blocked the regulation nationwide, finding ATF acted beyond the scope of its statutory authority. The Biden administration asked the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit to halt the lower court's decision, and the appeals court declined to do so regarding two challenge portions of ATF's restrictions. The Fifth Circuit expedited the Biden administration's appeal and is set to hear arguments in September. In addition to asking the Supreme Court to put district court's order on hold, the Biden administration argued that under a stay, the challengers would be free to make, sell and buy weapons, part kits, and only would need to comply with federal requirements that apply to commercial sales of other firearms. The district court's universal vacator is irreparably harming the public and the government by reopening the floodgates to the tide of untraceable ghost guns flowing into our nation's communities, the Solicitor General, Elizabeth Preloga, wrote in an emergency application to the court. Preloga added, Once those guns are sold, the damage is done. Some will already be in the hands of criminals and others prohibited persons. And when they are inevitably used in crimes, they are untraceable. But the plaintiffs challenging ATF's rule argued that by defining frame or receiver and firearm under federal law, the agency overstepped its authority under the Gun Control Act. By seeking to bring within its purview items that facilitate the making of firearms by private citizens for their own use, ATF has sought to fundamentally alter the policy choices made by Congress in 1968, one group of gun owners and retailers told the court. Those policy choices are for Congress to make and not for ATF to make. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. The Supreme Court on Tuesday, 8th of August, agreed to freeze a lower court's order that bars the government from regulating so-called ghost guns. These are untraceable homemade weapons as firearms under federal law. The brief order grants the Biden administration's request to allow the regulations to remain in effect while legal challenges play out in the courts of law. Ghost guns are kits that a user can buy online to assemble a fully functional firearm at home. They have no serial numbers, do not require background checks, and provide no transfer records for easy traceability. Critics say they're attractive to people who are legally prohibited from buying firearms. The vote was 5-4. Chief Justice John Roberts and fellow Conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined with the court's three liberal judges to allow the rule to take effect. Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh would have denied the application. In 2022, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, ATF, updated its regulations to define the kits as firearms under the law so that the government could more carefully track them. The rule does not prohibit the sale of possession of any ghost gun kit, nor does it block an individual from purchasing such a kit. Instead, it requires compliance with federal laws that impose conditions on the commercial sale of firearms. Those conditions include requirements that commercial manufacturers and sellers mark products with serial numbers and keep records to allow law enforcement to trace firearms used in crimes. In late June, Judge Reed O'Connor of the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas held that the agency had exceeded its authority in promulgating the rule and blocked it nationwide. A federal appeals court declined to put on hold two key challenge provisions of the regulation. In the emergency filing with the Supreme Court, Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloga warned the justices that over the last several years, police departments around the nation have confronted an explosion of crimes involving ghost guns. Congress recognized that limiting the federal firearms laws to functional firearms would invite evasion, and it thus broadly defined firearm to include any weapon that will or is designed to or may readily be converted to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive. Elizabeth Preloga wrote, "The challenge to the ATF regulations was brought by two Texas residents who own components that they intend to manufacture into ghost guns for their personal use. The rule blocks them from being able to directly purchase additional parts. A handful of retailers of ghost gun kits, as well as a gun rights group, also challenged the rule."
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Come here now.
We will return. I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Millions of emails that were meant to be sent to the .mil US military email addresses have been sent instead to the Malian government with the .ml domain inboxes. What makes this slip-up more critical for the US government is that the Malian government is a Russian ally. There has been other US government sensitive leaks in the past, like how Massachusetts Air National Guardsman Jack Teixeira leaked dozens of highly sensitive Ukraine war documents from the US Department of Defense. Teixeira was arrested by the FBI from his mother's home earlier this year. Pentagon leaked documents. Some media call it funny, the leak of millions of US military emails to Mali web operator. The security of the sensitive information in the DoD seems to be borderline ridiculous. The typo, a common spelling error, misdirects Pentagon messages to a company running Mali's internet domain. First revealed by the Financial Times, emails to and from the Pentagon have been sent to the Malian government domain name inboxes because some send their email to a .ml address instead of .mil, which is meant for the US military. Mali is a Russian ally, and the US government is worried that sensitive information has reached the hands of its adversary. The Pentagon has since blocked emails sent from its department to the .ml domains, but it is not able to stop those outside of the department sending emails intended for the Pentagon to the Malian domain.
Yeah, just crazy, this type of story. Good morning, Marky. This morning, a Russian ally has access to an email server that the Pentagon says millions of emails got leakedly sent to as a result of a small typo. The man who alerted the United States about all this says the country of Mali now has access to emails that contain sensitive personal information, like, for example, the itineraries of military leaders.
The millions of U.S. military emails misdirected to Mali have been called a typo leak and thus expose highly sensitive information, which include diplomatic documents, tax returns, passwords and travel itinerary of top military officials and officers. Experts had warned the Pentagon for over a decade over the common spelling mistakes. However, email traffic continues to flow steadily to the .ml domain with no end in sight. What is the controversy surrounding the Pentagon leaked documents?
Well, there's been some highly classified documents that have been leaked from the Pentagon, and they're online. They've been exposed, and they give a rare look into how the United States is spying on its allies, like Ukraine, Israel, and even South Korea. Also, some documents have been revealed that show the extent to which we have penetrated the Russian Ministry of Defense and the Russian mercenary organization, the Wagner Group. These intercepted communications show pretty much that they could be in danger of being cut off, and they reveal the weaknesses in Ukrainian weaponry and Ukrainian air defense, and as well as their battalion sizes and their readiness for war. So these are really highly sensitive documents that have been leaked in recent weeks. They are online, they have gone viral, and they have put the United States military and our intelligence community at tremendous risk, and in the extent of which will cause long-term damage as far as our intelligence community goes.
Joanne Zorbier, a Dutch internet entrepreneur who manages Mali's country domain through a contract, was first to identify the problem a decade ago. He was collecting the emails misdirected to this domain since January in order to convince the US government to take the issue seriously. He holds close to 120,000 of such messages. Almost 1,000 arrived in one day alone. Although it is not known how long these emails were being sent before Zorbier discovered them.
Well, in the last couple of weeks, there's been reports of a major leak of emails that were intended for the U.S. military, which has the suffix MIL, and they were, due to typo errors, they went to the country of Mali, the server servicing the emails to that country, and the suffix there is .ml. This story first came out on July 17 in the Financial Times, and then was repeated and picked up again 10 days later on July 27.
It has been said that much of the email is spam and none is marked as classified. However, it has been reported that some of these emails include data on U.S. military personnel, contractors, and their families. The contents include medical data, identity document information, crew lists for ships, staff lists at bases, maps of installations, photos of bases, naval inspection reports, criminal complaints against personnel, internal investigations, etc. What has been some of the information that has been leaked through the emails?
Documents sent to the wrong address that were intended for the United States by the United Kingdom. It all occurred because of a mistake, a typo in the email address, whereas for the United States, the suffix is ML, and for Mali, it's MIL. And so several thousands of emails have been sent mistakenly to Mali, a West African country who is an ally of Russia, as opposed to the United States.
One of the highly sensitive information that has been revealed through the emails was a detailed travel plans for the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, General James McConville, for a visit to Indonesia in May. The email included a full list of room numbers, McConville and 20 others' itinerary, and even the details of the collection of the U.S. Army Chief of Staff's room key at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Jakarta.
First, point you to our colleagues at the Department of Defense. This is really more for them to speak to, but as I understand it, they have now for quite some time have in place a tool that stops outbound emails that don't have the .mil at the end from going. There's not a huge amount that they can do for people sending emails into the .mil domain from outside. For instance, if you're working on your home computer and you're sending a document to your work account or something like that, which actually you shouldn't be working on official stuff at home anyway, but they have done training of DoD employees, as I understand it, to warn them about that practice. But when it's inbound to a .mil address without MIL, there's not a lot that the Pentagon can do to stop that. But there.
The emails are not only limited to the U.S. military. Emails from other departments and countries have also wound up at the Malian domain. The Dutch Army, that uses the army.nl domain, also faces similar problems. The United Kingdom has also sent emails intended for the U.S. military to Mali, along with emails from the Australian Defense Ministry. One of the emails from Australia included corrosion problems affecting Australian F-35s and an artillery manual.
Well, the Department of Defense, they have assessed the damage and they've tried to pretty much mitigate what the damage is. They reviewed the validity of the photograph documents, which is circulating on social media. Which obviously which appear to contain this highly sensitive information. But the Pentagon, where the initial leaks have come from, have taken steps to tighten the flow of these highly sensitive documents, which have caused the problem They're normally available on any given day to hundreds of people across the government. But since the leak, they've taken steps to tighten up that flow. And the Joint Chief Staff, which compromises the Defense Department's most senior uniform leadership, is examining distribution lists to who gets to look at these reports as well.
Officials from the U.S. Ministry of Defense also misspelled the domain name for their U.S. counterparts when trying to contact them. A U.K. Ministry of Defense spokesman has said that the emails did not contain any information that could compromise operational security. It is not clear, however, how many emails have been sent from the U.K. Ministry of Defense and in what time period, or if it is still occurring.
Well, this problem regarding the fact that a typo error ending an email with ML, which goes to Mali instead of MIL, which is the military network, that it's been noted for 10 years. The contractor who was handling the emails or in charge of the server servicing internet connections and email connections to Mali first pointed out 10 years ago. His name is Johannes Zerbier, and he's brought it to the attention of the U.S. military for many years. Nothing much has been done about it because, frankly, I don't think it's a serious problem. It's been, you know, built up to be an issue now. The timing is very interesting because, of course, we just had the Africa-Russia summit in St. Petersburg. The story came out initially on July 17, and then it was repeated in a lot of media, CNN and BBC and a lot of other media, 10 days later, which was the exact day of the opening of the Africa-Russia summit.
This news came just days after China-based hackers gained access to U.S. government emails through a Microsoft cloud system. Microsoft stated that a China-based hacking group identified as Storm0558 breached email accounts from approximately 25 organizations, including U.S. government agencies. The Biden administration has vowed consequences for the culprits. Were the email leaks accidental or deliberate?
Well, when you're dealing with complex governmental systems and structures, it's hard. You can never tell what an individual or individuals are thinking. We assume it was accidental, but the Dutch entrepreneur who was contracted to manage Mali's domain, he said that this has been happening for over a decade, and despite his repeated attempts to warn the U.S. government, nothing was done.
Earlier this year, Microsoft and the U.S. Defense Department were investigating an error that people familiar with the matter said it has exposed at least a terabyte of military emails, including personal information and conversation between officials. The Pentagon Cyber Command is investigating the leak, but Microsoft, which operates the Azure Cloud Computing Service, which stored the data.
25 organizations, 2 government agencies, multiple accounts. This is the scale of China's latest cyber attack on the United States. The revelation has been made by America's own technology corporation, Microsoft. The details have been further corroborated by the U.S. Department of Commerce. What exactly happened and who was behind it? Well, the culprit is a China-based hacking group, which is referred to as Storm0558. It secretly targeted and compromised U.S. government accounts in a targeted cyber espionage campaign. The breaches have been mitigated, but an FBI investigation into the motives is still underway.
In 2021, the Pentagon said it will not move forward with a massive Microsoft contract to develop the department's cloud computing program. Instead, it split up the $9 billion contract between Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and Oracle. Now the Microsoft-operated Azure cloud computing service was compromised. A special operations command server was accessible without a passport. Are the email leaks to Mali important?
Well, there have been, going back to the 70s, we had a CIA officer, Philip Agee, who wrote a book documenting his activities for several years working in the CIA, well, actually almost 10 years in the CIA in Latin America. After that, we had John Stockwell, who was a CIA officer in charge of the CIA operations in Angola, speak out, documenting what the kinds of things they do.
This is not the first time sensitive U.S. documents have been leaked. In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg, who was a military analyst at the time, disclosed a secret history of American lies and deceit in Vietnam, which came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. The papers were comprised of 7,000 government pages revealing deceptions by presidents who exceeded their authority, bypassed Congress, and misled the American people.
Well, in 1971, there was an incident called the release of the Pentagon Papers, and that's probably the most famous and impactful leak of classified documents in United States history. Pretty much, in a nutshell, it was Daniel Ellsberg, which was probably considered the most famous whistleblower to date. He leaked a report commissioned by the U.S. military about the Vietnam War. And this war, obviously, or conflict, which it was known at the time, politically speaking, it was widely criticized at home and abroad. And the report revealed the extent into which the U.S. government had kept the details of this war from the public. And so the New York Times used these documents to publish this blockbuster expose on the scope of Americans' actions in Vietnam.
Ellsberg died this June at the age of 92 after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. The disclosures led to him and his colleague being charged with espionage, conspiracy, and other crimes, which carried a total of 111 years in prison. However, the judge dismissed the charges on grounds of government misconduct. The pursuit of Ellsberg by Nixon's government led to Nixon's resignation in 1974. What are some of the major Pentagon document leaks in U.S. history?
Of course, there have been hugely important leaks and releases of classified information going back to Daniel Ellsberg releasing the Pentagon Papers, which was a Rand Study report, thousands of pages documenting what was really going on in Vietnam, which contrasted very much with the story in the media. You know, more recently, we had the WikiLeaks revelations, the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, the CIA plans and projects in the Vault 7. So those were really, truly important releases of classified information. The U.S. security state is extremely hostile to that. Of course, Julian Assange is languishing in prison. He's been locked up or effectively imprisoned for 10 years now. He's never been charged with a single crime. He has been charged, but he's never been convicted of a single crime. And he's there's a looming extradition to the United States.
Earlier this year, the FBI arrested Massachusetts Air National Guardsman Jack Teixeira after he was accused of being involved in the biggest national security breach in the last 10 years. Teixeira, who held the third lowest rank in the Air Force, is accused of uploading top-secret documents on a social messaging platform for gamers. He allegedly released documents in a chat room of up to 50 people, which he administered.
The U.S. government apparently didn't adequately secure its top-secret files, but when it came to arresting the 21-year-old accused of leaking the documents, the FBI came heavily armed and mob-handed. But the visuals of the dramatic arrest go nowhere to answering the key question today: how it is that a relative junior in the Massachusetts Air National Guard allegedly had access to reams of highly classified documents in the first place, and was then able to download them and share them with his gaming friends online.
A cyber transport systems journeyman at the Guardsman working with IT infrastructure. It is not clear whether he had or needed a security clearance. This job may have required him to work with and protect sensitive communication channels. The document posted are said to be highly sensitive Ukraine war documents.
I think that the United States looks at emails from abroad as a problem that is not our own. And I think it's almost a sense of this arrogance where if it's not our problem, then we don't have to address it. These emails that have been sent from the United Kingdom and other countries that are not getting sent to us, but are getting sent to other domains and other countries, is their responsibility. It's the country of origin's responsibility not only to get the emails to the designated location, but to do an investigation as why they didn't get to the designated.
The United States government often brags about its technology and state-of-the-art security systems, while it is being ridiculed for making the most mundane mistakes in its most sensitive departments. Just this year, several breaches and leaks have occurred in the Pentagon, some of which military officials have little or no control over and are unable to stop. Sending emails to the wrong address has been going on for more than a decade or longer, and Pentagon officials had ignored them even after being warned, compromising their country's security.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. Today, we're going to briefly look at some of these Pentagon leaks. And these leaks that are coming from the Pentagon, they are not a new thing, but they have happened time and time again. The Pentagon, they can't seem to keep things from getting out, which shows that A, people on the inside of the Pentagon, they want to expose some of the evil that happens there, and B, the security of the Pentagon is really not as strong as it claims to be. The most recent leaks, it came in April, as two sets of intelligence documents were allegedly leaked to the internet by an airman named Jack Teixeira, who was part of the so-called Air National Guard. Most of the documents, they were on the Russian special operation in Ukraine, but they also contained intelligence assessments on nations like North Korea, China, Iran, and the UAE. And one of the most important findings in these leaked documents, it revealed that the Zionist plot was to work with the so-called United States of America to launch a military operation, against the Islamic Republic of Iran. The document specifically stated that, quote, Israeli defense leaders are advocating for increased risk-taking to counter Iran, including proposing bilateral Israeli and U.S. operations. This comes as Washington and the Zionist entity have been carrying out joint drills aimed at simulating an attack on the Islamic Republic of Iran. Findings, they are to no surprise, as the Zionists and Americans have been attempting to wage a soft war on Iran for years. This is all simply because Iran refuses to bend to the will of the Zionists and Americans. These leaked papers, they expose the United States for the internal security issues it has, because Jack, he was just a 21-year-old who was relatively new into the military, and he allegedly exposed the secrets of the so-called U.S. intelligence community. It's clear, it's very clear, that America is not as strong as she claims to be. It's also clear that the settler colonies of America and Israel are both two evil, destructive forces trying to have dominance over the world. But alhamdulillah, people and nations are rising up against this evil. And for those of us who are living in the West, we must organize. We must organize to fight against American and Western imperialism. We must always maintain the call to free the land from Euro-Americans and to free the land from these Zionists. Free the people, free the land.